Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies, this is Pardes from Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Vaera. We're nearing the end of the calendar year, so this is a good time that many people think about making donations. If you would like to make a donation to Pardes, any amount will help us out and make a real difference in our mission of educating Jews of all types. Your donation can be made online at any time via pardes.org. That's PARDES.org. Look for the donate link near the top of the page on the right-hand side. Thank you very much in advance. This week, Vaera with Rabbi Dr. Mish Hammer Kassoy. Rabbi Mish Hammer Kassoy is a member of the Pardes faculty and also serves as the Pardes Director of Admissions. And now, Rabbi Mish Hammer Kassoy.
In the words of the political philosopher Michael Walzer, wherever people know the Bible and experience oppression, the Exodus has sustained their spirits and sometimes inspired their resistance. At first glance, that is because of the miracles. Our Parsha, Parsha Vayera, chapter 6 through 9 of Exodus, could have been made into a great many movies. The bulk of the Parsha, chapter 7, 8, and 9, relate to the highlights of Seder night. The Blessed One brought 10 plagues on the Egyptians in Egypt, and the first 7 of them are in this week's Parsha. Dam, Tzvardeya, Kinim, Arov, Dever, Shchin, Barad. Blood, frogs, lice, the mixture of wild animals, pestilence, boils, and hail. Tune in next week for Arbe, Choshech, and Makat Bechorot. Locusts, darkness, and the plague of the firstborn. Is there anything more miraculous, more spectacular, more worthy of a movie? It's a story of light and darkness, of wicked against righteousness. Again, an hour-long chase scene where the hero, God, sweeps down and saves the damsel in distress, Am Yisrael, defeating the wicked Paro. Summed up beautifully in a couple of weeks, Hashem yilechem lechem v'atem tacharishun. God fights for you guys, and you just sit quiet. The Passover Haggadah tells this part of the story as climactic proof of the singular and spectacularly miraculous nature of the Exodus, with such an emphasis that even Moshe doesn't get mentioned in the Haggadah. And the Lord took us out of Egypt with a strong hand and with an outstretched forearm and with great awe and with signs of wonders. V'yotzienu Hashem Mitzrayim b'yad chazaka b'zro netuya b'maro b'mora gadol b'otot u'b'moftim. V'yotzienu Hashem Mitzrayim lo al yedei malach, lo al yedei saraf, lo al yedei shaliach, ela HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'chvodo u'v'atzmo. Not at the hand of an angel, nor through a saraf, not through a messenger, but directly by the Blessed Holy One, God's self. In this telling of the story, the Jews seem to be essentially passive, victims of oppression and objects of redemption. We've been oppressed and enslaved by the wicked Paro. We've been made helpless, and we stand at the total mercy of God. God and God's righteous mercy releases God's wrath on the wicked Egyptians and redeems us while we stand silently and watch. In broad strokes, that's the easy read of chapter 7, 8, and 9. But even in the movies, and how much more so in the miracle of Exodus, life is not that simple. And that is the part of the story that I want to focus on today. Chapter 6. But before getting into the plagues, there's that random chapter, chapter 6. What is the relationship of this chapter to the Parsha as a whole? How are we to integrate this chapter into the story? Furthermore, chapter 6 is a chapter that has some confusing features. So if you'll allow me to spend a few minutes outlining the challenges of the chapter 6 and some potential solutions before articulating my overall thesis, that chapter 6 forces us to, this is my thesis. Chapter 6 forces us to nuance the binary between wicked and good, as well as between subject and object, victim and perpetrator, and even between slavery and freedom. To understand the responsibility that B'nai Israel have both in their own victimhood and in their redemption, and thus challenging us to revisit chapter 7, 8, and 9 and nuance our reading of this tremendously miraculous story. This is a thesis about the complexity of power and responsibility, at which I'm especially happy to develop this week because it gives me a chance to begin thinking and also shamelessly plug Pardes's Winter Learning Intensive on the subject of power, privilege, and responsibility, January 6th through 10th, which I have the pleasure of directing. We are nearly fully subscribed with well over 100 participants, but at the time of recording this, there's still a few more slots for daily or week-long participation. So I urge you to get in on it. Now that you know where we're heading, let me go back and identify the features of Chapter 6 I want to talk about. First of all, Chapter 6 is one heck of a one-sided conversation. In verse 6:1, God says to Moshe. In verse 2, God says to Moshe again. In verse 10, God says to Moshe with no intervening responses along the way, no events, and no conversation. Finally, in verse 12, Moshe responds saying, Israel's not going to listen. Why would Pharaoh listen? In 6:13, God says to Moshe and Aaron again, V'yedaber Hashem el Moshe ve'el Aaron v'yitzaveim el b'nei Yisrael ve'el paro melech Mitzrayim lotzi et b'nei Yisrael mi'eretz Mitzrayim. Now, this verse, secondly, is really confusing. He is commanding el b'nei Yisrael ve'el paro to release the slaves from Egypt. Why is God commanding the Israelites? And finally, with my third objection or confusion in the Parsha is the second half of the chapter, verses 14 through 30, begin an enumeration of the genealogy of Israel, largely repeating what we already worked pretty hard to find interesting 3 weeks back in Vayigash. And then after telling us this genealogy of Reuven, Shimon, and Levi, suddenly loses interest itself midstream after the introduction of Moshe and Aaron. Okay, let me go. So those are my three questions. Let me go back to the second question first. The content of verse 13. He commanded El B'nai Israel, the El Paro, to release the slaves from Egypt. Why is God commanding the Israelites? What on earth are they doing? Isn't it the Egyptians who are doing the enslaving? Okay, the JPS disambiguates and reads the word El is not to commanding to the Jewish people, but with respect to the Jewish people. So the JPS translates, so the Lord spoke to Moshe and Aaron in regard to the Israelites and Paro, king of Egypt, instructing them to deliver the Israelites from the land of Egypt. And many of the Midrashim and commentaries, including Rashi, Ibn Ezra, also go in that direction. They say it like this. The command is to Moshe and Aaron to suffer the people, to be patient with the people. What can you expect from the people? Slaves are bound to be slavish. This is your duty, Moshe and Aaron. God is commanding Moshe and Aaron with respect to the Israelites. Give them a break. Be patient. But the Talmud Yerushalmi, Rosh Hashanah, chapter 3, Halacha 5, goes in a different direction. There, Rabbi Nechemiah says, Divrei Torah aniyim bimkoman vashirin bimakom acher. That is to say, sometimes words that are cryptic in one place can be explained elsewhere. That is to say, the Torah didn't spell out the commandment in chapter 6 of Exodus, but Jeremiah explains the whole story there. This is the passage in the Talmud. That according to the Talmud, the Yerushalmi, B'nai Israel were actually given a commandment to release the slaves just as Paro was. Amar Rabbi Shmuel bar Rabbi Yitzchak, V'yedaber Hashem o Moshe ve'el Aron v'yitzaveim el B'nai Israel ve'el Paro melech Mitzrayim lotzi et B'nai Israel mi'eretz Mitzrayim. Al matziveim al parshat shiluach avadim. V'atche kahayidam a Rabbi Hila, lo ne'en shu Yisrael ela parshat shiluach avadim. Haru dichtiv miketz sheva shanim tishlechu ish et achiv ha'ivri. Rabbi Shmuel bar Rav Yitzchak said, God spoke to Moshe and Aaron and command Bnei Yisrael and Paro, king of Egypt, to release Bnei Yisrael from the land of Egypt. About what was Bnei Yisrael commanded? About the release of slaves, as we see from what Rav Hila said. Israel was not punished because of the laws of the release of slaves, as it says, in Jeremiah. Thus said the Lord, the God of Israel, I made a covenant with your fathers when I brought them out of the land of Egypt, the house of bondage, saying, in the seventh year, each of you must let go any fellow Hebrew who may be sold to you. When he served 6 years, you must set him free. But your fathers would not obey me or give ear. This is a remarkable passage in the Yerushalmi. Let me make clear what it says. Many centuries later, 6th century BCE, after the Exodus, Jeremiah prophesizes that God's anger is burning against the Israelites, and God is going to exile them from the land of Israel because they themselves have come to mistreat their slaves. Rabbi Hila, or Elai, takes this literally in two directions. He says, not only are the Jews being exiled for the specific sin of not releasing their slaves, but they were indeed commanded about this sin on the day they went out of Egypt, i.e., in our Parsha, Parsha Va'era. That is what the meaning of and command in this week's Parsha, in verse 16, and command Bnei Israel. The Jews were commanded to let go of their slaves. Now, it's a clever juxtaposition. But we can ask ourselves, why on earth now? Why would God command Bnei Yisrael in this week's Parsha to let their slaves go when they themselves are suffering under the yoke of slavery? One possibility, and I think this is the simple possibility, is that it's a future commandment, that they should know now that these same rules will apply to them as well. There's one set of standards. Hillel's, what's hateful to you, don't do to others. You, Bnei Israel, stand in judgment of the Egyptians, and you think you'd never be like your enemy. They are somehow subhumanly cruel and very different from you. Let go of that binary now, says God. All humans are just that, humans. Know that even as you are pitted against the Egyptians, you could also find yourself in the same situation. A time will come when being Jewish is a privilege rather than a yoke. And when it is, don't take that privilege for granted. Commit to being aware of that privilege and dismantle it. We must do it differently when the tables are turned. This is beautiful and inspiring. And I could be content here. But Rav Meir Simcha HaKohen of Dvinsk, the Meshech Chochma, takes it a step further and along the way solves our third interpretive challenge, that of the derailed genealogy. Yitachen ki gam az b'Mitzrayim hayu gdolei ha'uma asher hayu sarim nechpadim ve'efratim v'hem hayu mish'abdim et b'nei Yisrael la'avadim shemachru ha'Mitzrayim lehem. Ulai hayu hem ha'shlosha shvatim Ruven, Shimon ve'Levi hinhigu sarara b'Mitzrayim. ומיהם היו בני חורים הרבה ושרים אשר היו משעבדים את בני ישראל הנמכרים להם מהממשלה של פרו ולכן ציווה השם יתברך שבני ישראל וגם פרו יוציאו את בני ישראל מהשיבוד ולכן שמח לזה ייחוס השלושה שבטים ומסיים הוא אהרון ומשה אשר אמר השם להם הוציאו את בני ישראל מארץ מצרים על צבאותם, שיהיו כל משפחה ושבט צבא בפני עצמו, ולא ישתעבדו ישראל זה את זה. It seems that in Egypt there were great members of our nation who were ministers and royalty, and they would purchase their own people from the Egyptians and enslave them. And the Meshech Chochma goes on to surmise that the second half of the chapter 6, which enumerates the genealogy of Reuven, Shimon, and Levi, the three senior tribes of Israel, is because they were precisely the ones who did the enslaving. And therefore, God was commanding them, as well as Paro, to release Bnei Israel from slavery. The Torah Shlema, Rav Menachem Kasher supports the interpretation of the Meshech Chochmah with the help of ancient midrashim that were not available to the Meshech Chochmah. And then he adds, "This is an important moral message that humans are not entitled to be free, true B'nei Chorin, if they themselves are enslaving their fellows. And therefore, it is a prerequisite to the exodus from Egypt, the Jews that were commanded, that they themselves should release their slaves. And based on this very merit, they went out free, and they became qualified to accept upon themselves the yoke of the sovereignty of heaven." As the Yerushalmi teaches, from whence do we know that a slave is exempt from saying the Shema, which is the expression of the acceptance of the yoke of the sovereignty of heaven? As it says, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, the person who has no other master besides the Blessed Holy One, to exclude the slave who has another master. And as Kiddushin 22 says, because B'nai Israel are my slaves and not slaves to other slaves. And this fundamental truth, the value of God, of loving God's creatures, what is hateful to you, don't do to others, was declared loud and clear by the Torah 3,200 years ago as the very first mitzvah to the Jewish people in Egypt. The Torah Shlema goes on to say, to our great dismay, this idea has not yet penetrated human hearts. Who knows when eyes will be opened to see and really internalize this basic truth? Another beautiful message. How easy it is to see the world in binaries, good and bad, victim and oppressor, subject and object. But a precondition to God's miraculous intervention in Israel's decision to let go of these is Israel's decision to let go of these binaries, to recognize that they themselves can and do act as oppressor. And until B'nai Israel recognizes the ways that they are subjects in their own oppression and responsible for their own destiny, first of all, by releasing their own slaves. I've resolved interpretive challenges, numbers 2 and 3, which is B'nai Israel being commanded and why the half-baked genealogy. But what about the first one? Why does chapter 6 open with what seems to be such a one-sided and repetitive conversation coming from God's side? The Netziv suggests that's because it is so very hard to internalize the message that we're hearing now. To find the courage and faith to act in this way is a lot harder than standing by silently while God fights our battles. So what I've tried to argue is that chapter 6 stands in tension with the remainder of the parsha, the miracles of chapters 7, 8, and 9, and that those miracles become possible because of the hard work and the realism that we find in chapter 6. The Haggadah lays out a liturgy that emphasizes the fantastically miraculous hand of God in the Exodus. But Michael Walzer, in his remarkably insightful book, Exodus and Revolution, highlights a totally different narrative, one that has been leveraged not only in liberation theologies and in the long struggle for racial freedom in America, but also by Savonarola, Calvin, John Knox, Benjamin Franklin, Lincoln Stevens, Severina Croato, and the Zionists right and left, among others. They've all used Exodus for their revolutionary ends. Exodus has played a remarkably large role in revolutionary politics, even without revolutionaries having waited for God to strike down the wicked with a series of damaging plagues, and for good reason. In Walzer's words, the Exodus is an account of deliverance or liberation expressed in religious terms, but it is also secular. That is, this worldly and historical account. More important, it is a realistic account in which miracles play a part, but which itself is not miraculous. The Israelites are not, after all, magically transported to the promised land. They are not carried out on the eagle's wings of Exodus 19. They must march to get there, and the march is full of difficulties, crises, struggles, all realistically presented, as if to invite human as well as divine resolution. In an early rabbinic commentary on Exodus, the famous sage Rabbi Yehuda Nasi is quoted as saying, "Through the strength of God, Israel went out of Egypt, as it is said. By strength of hand, the Lord brought us out of Egypt. But the commentary continues. There is another interpretation. With an alertness of their own, Israel went out of Egypt, as it is said, and thus shall you eat the Paschal lamb, with your loins girded, your shoes on your feet, and your staff in your hand. I sympathize with the second interpretation, says Michael Walzer. Chapter 6 reminds us of just this imperative, one that will come up again and again. We can now reread the miraculous chapters 7, 8, and 9 and see how even there we need leaders, Moshe and Aaron, to lead the way and to take essential roles in administering the plagues, holding the rod and striking the dust and the Nile to bring up the frogs and the vermin. Similarly, we ourselves have to demand freedom, to be God's mouthpiece in the world, demanding, Shlach et ami, let my people go. And just as it reminds us that we must have courage and faith and be agents in our own redemption, it reminds us that we are also capable of the same wickedness that Paro perpetrates against us. If we are not agents in our own redemption and in redemption of others, there's no grounds for suggesting that we ourselves should be redeemed. So to summarize, Va'era is a parsha of great miracles, of righteous anger and deserved suffering. The weak Israelites are swept from the hands of the strong Egyptians, not by their power, but by the divine mercy. A movement from slaves of Egypt to slaves of God, from objects of one power to objects of another. But before all of that, which takes place in chapters 7, 8, and 9, there's another important chapter, chapter 6. And that is a chapter about frustration and impatience of God trying to convince even Moshe that we will be saved, that we need not be forever powerless and victimized. And in fact, even now, we're not just victims and objects. We're also subjects. We're actors and determinators of our own fate, as evidenced by the Yerushalmi's interpretation that we were commanded to free our own slaves. And its expansion in the Meshech Chochmah. And indeed, as Michael Walzer argues, this is why our story has become such an essential one, not just for Am Yisrael, but for everyone who struggles to improve their lot in our world. May God come to our aid now as God did then. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Mishamer Kassoy. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you in the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.